Chapter 17, A Family Stepping Forward, The DNA Message. In their Northern California home, an older couple was reading to each other the stories from Steve's site. They read the articles and discussed Steve and Maria's success at making a manure gas company. Frank Trent said to his wife, Bev, "Look at these young people. They play folk rock and designed a new power source for India. And here they say they don't know whether they have real parents. Wouldn't it be nice if this Steve was our lost child? We could have a DNA test done to see if our genes match. Our beliefs certainly match. Do you think that's crazy? And look, it says here Steve was born in the same year and day as our child and in the same town. I hate to get my hopes up, but this is more exciting than an infomercial." The man looked at his wife, a mix of emotions playing across his face. "The only thing that's probably similar between them and us is a pair of genes rather than genetics," his wife answered. "But it couldn't hurt to send them an email, I suppose. How could a kidnapper be stupid enough to leave that much evidence behind? It seems they would have forged the certificate better than that."
"Criminals never cover their tracks completely. Anyway, there is no real evidence left. Don't you remember? The main government birth certificate files were destroyed in a fire the year our son was born. The kidnappers probably did it."
The man's wife nodded in agreement. Sitting at the computer, Frank composed an email that explained their theory to Steve and Maria.
"I don't always trust science, and I'm waiting for some one-in-a-million chance to pop up that DNA testing is unreliable, even when people tested are, in actuality, family. I know this sounds pessimistic, and I hope this isn't the case, though it seems laws of nature and humans are the exceptions to the rule rather than being invariable."
He also stated that even if their DNA test proved negative, they were just a nice old couple who were just as curious as Steve and Maria about the verity of their parents. It could be just a coincidence that his birth certificate showed he was born on the same day and the same year as their own lost son. Steve and Maria were collecting numerous friends, members of the ashram, and others they had met to organize and develop a system to create a larger manure gas company in India. They were hired to start making other small plants near the ashram with help from the Indian political mediator they had met as they merged with the local government. They didn't give up their music, nor did Maria give up bagels and pastry making. Over time, she slowly developed a small chain of stores. Checking their email one day, Maria exclaimed, "Steve, somebody on our website has written to say that they think they might be your real parents. They want to compare DNA tests to see if you are related. That might prove almost as good as remembering back to before you were 2 years old. This might make the two of us lost children waiting to be found. It's funny, though, that they said in relation to the accuracy of science or facts that humans are the exception to the rule rather than being invariable, and they don't know why DNA tests could remain above this rule also. They said that you were born on the same day and in the same town as their child, and that they too have searched for mystical truths, so they are very similar psychically." Steve couldn't believe that this could mean anything, but he did believe in Lady Luck. "Let's write them and find out more. Maybe we have opened the blinds of ignorance and found a new world. But then again, we may never know if our parents are really our parents or not. We might as well try to solve this mystery." He knew that with so little to go on, he would probably stumble many times attempting to solve this puzzle. "Let's tell them about our disabilities and our frustrations relating with our parents, just to share, and see if they respond with compassion," Maria suggested. Steve and Maria communicated with the couple over the next few weeks. Frank and Bev wrote that they wanted to drive to San Francisco to visit. They mentioned that they would enjoy getting away from home if nothing else came out of the visit, and that they wanted to see what the latest generation had created. And while they were in San Francisco, they would have their DNA tested. When Frank and Beverly Trent arrived at Steve and Maria's house, they all sat solemnly in the living room and talked about their lives. Steve explained what he had been doing in San Francisco, revealing in more detail his experiences in music, bagels and pastries, manure gas, and his wish to start a company making telescopes. He also mentioned that Maria's birth certificate had discrepancies and that there had been a successful coup to overthrow the Colombian government when she was a small child. Maria's parents might have been secretly exiled when Maria was a child and couldn't come back to find her. They might have been threatened that someone would kill her or them if they returned. Steve mentioned that he had been mistreated in the mental hospital, having been prescribed the wrong medicines. He revealed that for months all he could do was drool and shake, during which time he had suffered a constant throbbing migraine that felt like he had been clubbed over the head.
Well, it certainly seems that you both have led amazing lives, Frank said. Now you say you've built telescopes and want to start a company building them. I once had a job in L.A. making telescope lenses and mirrors, but I got laid off after 6 months. My boss thought I couldn't focus, which is ironic. Imagine a lens maker who can't focus, Frank chuckled. Bev shook her head, a small smile of amusement on her lips. It was, it seemed, a joke she'd heard many times. I did learn all about making eyepieces and mirrors, though, Frank continued. After that, I bottomed out and lived on the streets. One day I didn't have enough money to pay full price for a cup of coffee, and I told the waitress of my mistake. Suddenly, I saw out of the corner of my eye some guys from the FBI approach me. They took me away and locked me up for 6 months. When I was in jail, I did a lot of brooding, but I thought to myself, why should I be a victim? Why should I suffer persecution if nobody will respect me for being a victim? Why should I be a martyr? I thought to myself, I know I'm not a facade, and maybe I can teach other people to be open to change without forcing the issue, just like I thought they were slowly forcing on me through false imprisonment. I didn't want to force anything on anyone. I believe the martyrs of the world are really the children of God who are not really of this world, like you, suffering much more than me and without complaint. Accepting pain is childlike. Anyway, to continue, I had a degree in law, which I didn't really like. I liked telescopes more. I had become a lawyer because it was expected of me. I worked for a month as a district attorney, which was awful. It was the kind of job that somebody has to do, but I one day realized I didn't have to be the one to do it. I met Bev about the time I left the district attorney's office and got a position with a law firm. I was a beatnik lawyer, and Bev, of all things, was a nun at a church I used to go to. We studied the Bible together. We fell in love, and she had to leave her order. After that, we married. They looked at each other fondly. It wasn't long before I became discouraged with the job because I found law as petty as the criminals it tries to prosecute. I remember one case in particular which seemed more of a mental health case than a criminal one. I've thought about it a lot over the years, and I've learned a lot from it. It concerned a man named Harold who didn't know how to deal with his emotions. He was a very angry man accused of assault. I realized that sometimes anger can attach itself to someone like a leech. He tried to control it, but he did a very poor job of it. He was accused of uncontrollable violence and had convinced the court to let him do a lot of speaking on his own behalf in the court. He would have made a good preacher if it weren't for his bad temper and bad excuses. I remember almost exactly what he said. He described it as if he were writing a book about himself. It was, in fact, like an incomplete dream or a poorly written fiction story, I must say. He liked to yell at his girlfriend and messed her around a little bit. She drank a lot and often went to a girlfriend's house to stay because she was afraid of him. When she was gone, he sat alone in his house and literally listened to the wood floorboards squeak. He was too stingy to pay for the heat, so the house was always too cold. He was an emotional mess and stated in an obsessed, nearly psychotic manner that he believed the light in the house was very unfriendly, almost as if it were alive. He wouldn't pay for light fixtures, so the light bulbs hung naked from cords in the ceiling. There was no cheery glow in those lamps, and he had fixated on that fact. He often thought those naked bulbs were glaring at him, prying into his mind like those of an interrogation room, making him doubt and question himself as his own interrogator. Eventually, his wife stopped coming home altogether. He was a carpenter by trade, but was out of work and made ends meet as a freezer salesman. He talked about his wife so much to his few friends that he was nicknamed the Freezer Man. He'd heard them use the name when they thought he wouldn't hear. They thought he was too cold and cruel to his wife. One man said he wouldn't have been surprised to read in the paper one day that Harold had killed her and hidden her body in the basement freezer. When he found a new carpenter job, he thought everything would be fine. It wasn't long, however, before he discovered that the foreman was an egocentric authoritarian and treated his workers poorly. Harold didn't think that he could cope with this. One day, the foreman got particularly arrogant and intentionally made Harold so confused that he sanded a table across the grain. Harold thought the foreman had planned to do this to him just to play games with him and prove him stupid or insubordinate. Harold lost his temper and hit the foreman numerous times over the head with a 2x4, giving him a concussion. He insisted aggressively that the foreman enjoyed the beating. The judge interrupted and ordered him to hurry up, that he thought Harold lacked proper remorse for his actions, and that he didn't have time for Harold to describe all his excuses for doing what he did. Harold said he realized that it was one of life's lessons to not rub people across the grain, even though they do the same to you. Verbal abuse is purely subjective and shouldn't interfere with one's overall performance. One must control oneself no matter what. When the judge gave the sentence, he began with a few of his own metaphorical words. He said you don't need a lecture or a philosophy course to hammer a nail onto a board, nor does it take a large effort to control your temper. Then he gave Harold 6 months for aggravated assault. I couldn't say whether the judge was easy or hard on Harold, but I learned a lot from the experience. I had sympathy for him, even though I knew he had a bad temper and was a very petty individual. My poetic self kept comparing him to Jesus the carpenter. I wondered whether or not he was as practical as a carpenter symbolically, or whether he was as materialistically impractical as Jesus was in life. He didn't know whether he was to be the one who hammers or the one who is nailed. Saul, before he became Paul, surely didn't know hammer from nail, seeing as how he had probably nailed many a Christian before he converted to Christianity. It was a moderately fair trial, but I didn't like it. Being young, I couldn't see any crisp, clean logic in any of the trials I was in. I became too critical of myself and of the judicial system. I started to doubt not just my chosen profession, but myself too. I started to fall apart. I had a nervous breakdown because I thought I had become petty, prosecuting people for breaches of ego like jealousy and pride, rather than true crimes against humanity. I doubt that what people are arrested for is really a true representation of what they are guilty of. Many times they must have done other crimes, working up to the stage where they got caught. Because of my dislike of law, I abandoned my profession and worked for many years as a jack of all trades. When the internet came about, I started up a .com selling things from other companies. I also bought things in auctions and estate sales and sold those online too. I made $250,000 a year from it and retired within 4 years. We live frugally, but we get by. Frank stopped a moment, lost in thought. Then he turned to Steve and looked at him intently. I would like to help you start a company making telescopes. I have the training. I'm not an expert, but I could fairly easily piecemeal together a mirror grinding and polishing company with some help from you. Maybe we could make eyepieces too, since I have some training in that. Eyepieces are rather tedious to make, being so small. It could be an ongoing thing. We don't have to start right away. Frank stated his fear that if the person who had possibly kidnapped Steve was in any way related to them, that person might have similar DNA and it would be hard to prove that Frank is the real father. In an attempt to divert the conversation, Maria asked Frank if he would like some tea. Frank smiled. Yes, Maria, that would be wonderful. Maria boiled the water and steeped the tea, then served it in the tea set that Steve had taken from his supposed parents. To them, the teacup symbolized a vessel reclaimed from its uncaring owners, much like the story of the cup with Benjamin and Joseph in the Bible. They explained to Frank and Bev how they felt those stolen cups represented their lives, and how Steve and Maria had transcended the bondage of their parents and no longer felt held in hock, as they had almost pawned the tea set. Frank reached into the tote bag he had brought with him and pulled out a manuscript. I'm writing a book on practical mysticism, and this is my first draft. I have a line about cups in it that I thought you might read. It is about my own views about drinking in life through a cup of compassion and how I had done this when I was young, but found that I had to learn to be more practical. I'm trying to be a practical mystic. Read it. Maria took it and read aloud. The shallowest cup of human kindness. It is a leap of faith getting one's emotional balance after being denied self-worth while trying to drink from the cup of human kindness. Sadly, this cup is just a symbol of psychic and spiritual worth and is not capable of doling out spirituality. Its effect is only partial but still treasured. It is only a gesture and only brings the satisfaction of good faith rather than a free salvation. The prodigal son rarely gets the point of it, as many an innocent but uninformed child also fails to understand it is due to not having been educated in this value. It is unsurprising that it is valued frugally by some, while others fail to give this enchanted cup, which mesmerizes many, any significance. Sadly, the process of placing value on the sharing of one's lifeblood with others never comes to fruition until one loses this sharing. We learn of its significance only by being separated from it. It's almost as if we are symbolically caring for the world through this borrowed, vainglorious cup, as if Earth itself is a second-hand discard. We are putting value on something that appears to have much less value than we think, even though we consider it all along to be priceless. If we don't put spiritual guilt or beauty on this otherwise plain cup, and thusly embellish the meaning of drinking in life through this cup, we find that normal experience has little significance. If we don't reevaluate this cup of self-worth, we end up discarding ourselves as used and worthless. There are those who trust human nature and rely on poise. One should bear oneself properly to cause others to want to imitate and follow suit. We want to prove that we can be functional and carry the torch of simplistic things, hinting that unskilled emotion of love rather than flaunting it. Rather than revering it, people often idolize this cup that echoes the sharing of mutual contriteness. In contrast, rather than enjoying the drinking in of true affection and compassion in rare isolated moments on the Sabbath, most people attach themselves to the opposite material practicality and avoid this blind faith. Although the priest in this case seems to hold all of our faiths in the cup of Jesus, many times one cannot feel catharsis through one's spiritual effort when he raises the cup of communion. This sad emptiness brings up in the individual a need to go out and get the mechanism of convenience and expediency working, rather than vainly hoping that others like you and me will be struck with this fullness of grace through this cup of social communion, which one assumes would naturally bring society together in an expedient way to love. Rather than believing love will cure all, we have to go about in a slower way of fractional but not always futile repetitive practical exertion. Listening intently to Maria's melodic voice pronounce the words he had so carefully crafted, Frank studied the teacup in his hands. Struck by a memory, he sat up straight and interrupted her. "You said this tea set came from the house of the family that you think are the kidnappers? We had a tea set just like this. It was stolen during a break-in long ago. Is one of the teacups in the set broken in two places, on the handle and on the lip?" "Wait, before you show me the broken cup, let me point out on this good cup exactly where the cracks were patched so you can correlate the proof, so you know I'm not telling a fib. This could be important. This kidnapper could have stolen the cups from me a long time ago and foolishly kept them." After Frank described the cracks and Steve corroborated the evidence on the damaged cup, Steve said, "This is almost better proof than the DNA test. You described the cracks exactly." Referring to the unreliability of science in the case of the DNA test we're going to get, the variable might be science rather than humanity's quirks, proofs, and spiritual laws, Frank said. "The kidnapper might be a close relative." "This is like the miracle of the Holy Grail or something," exclaimed Steve. "I know that it's obtuse, but I couldn't resist comparing this to the mystical paradox we were discussing." "In a strange mystic way," Maria said, "this supports the power of the cup in preserving truth above practicality. Many times Steve and I have considered the value of the ego in practicality over compassion and transcendence, which is like the ethics that you describe in this book of yours. It is excellent, but I think the cup of human kindness has outdone practicality again. This tea set has proven more valuable than science. I know it is only a metaphor, but musicians like us use metaphors a lot. The proof of the spirit is becoming mundane." They continued to discuss the tea set and decided that they would eventually want to inspect the house Steve had grown up in to see if anything else that had been stolen at the time of the break-in might be there. "My life has been full of false and incomplete promises," Frank said. "In the 50s and 60s, I grew up on the threshold of new beliefs, standing at the door of truth but never walking in. At the time, I had no definition for what in was. Eventually, I realized that one has to activate the Godhead within oneself and show others that going from door to door looking for something isn't always the right answer. When you can find psychological and spiritual fulfillment behind the door to your own abode and can abide within yourself, that is the more practical way to enlightenment. It is an intangible door that you have to pass through, but a door nevertheless. We are always on the threshold of spiritual or material success, but none of it is good unless spiritual and material snobbishness is thrown out of the house. Spiritual pride can ruin a person to the point that one becomes unable to recognize opportunities of helping others from a metaphorically humbler threshold. Then there are those who are just spiritual beggars and tramps who live within the threshold of the Godhead and pretend that they are enlightened, but use it as a cover-up for their psychologically and spiritually bad lifestyles. I don't mean to put down the spiritually or physically homeless, because for a few months I lived on the streets, so to speak. I experienced this homelessness. One shouldn't have to live without a material or spiritual home to eventually realize what it's for, that it's a blessing on loan from God until mankind can pay for it. We found our spiritual and physical homes after being homeless, said Maria, realizing the ephemeral value of inner spiritual integrity and good materialism after being denied it. That is why we started the manure gas plant, to help improve those without a proper home and to cheapen power in India for everyone. Going back to the evidence of Steve being kidnapped, we could hope that the DNA test will be the double proof when we test the kidnapper's blood type. DNA tests are not yet perfected, however, said Frank with a hint of reserve. They spoke for a while longer before age and road fatigue forced Frank and Bev to return to their temporary apartment in town to rest. The next day, Steve, Maria, Frank, and Bev met up with a group they wanted to discuss non-polluting power sources. They were then invited to speak at a demonstration about a power company that was polluting the local water sources. At the demonstration, Steve rose to speak. When the Buddha came out of this house to see the suffering, we saw the blind, the mute, and the beggar. Those were all physically and symbolically muted people whom we would eventually defend, and for whom with this unsilenced tongue we would humbly preach. We have to be like the Buddha and like the mute person. We have been muted and yoked into obedience to the aesthetics and ethics of the Godhead, to liberally conform to proper guidelines while speaking of truth and freedom from the unfair yokes. Although we want to strike out just because we have been muted, we have to make an effort to control our protest and express ourselves in creative ways. That way we do not contribute to the problem but become part of the solution. It is true that we are denied many privileges, which, in a domino effect, denies us the ability to have the resources to change the world. It is only partial bondage, though. There is no transcendence. We are enslaved by some as-of-yet undefined specter. We must change ourselves, not just the world around us. We must also be self-suffering as we identify this specter. We shouldn't pollute our emotions with violent protest and its pollution, which is what we are against. We should signal and gesticulate the best we can to demonstrate how to stop the silence. It would be silly if a mute person were to express himself with a gun. Sign language is synonymous with the sign of the times. Someone shouted, "You're all wrong! The mute and downtrodden must strike out!" "Remember love," Steve admonished. "Mute, mute is too dilute! Strike out, strike out!" The larger portion of the crowd started chanting, "Mute! Mute! Strike out! Strike out!" Soon a riot erupted. As Steve and Maria turned to leave, a fellow speaker stopped them. "Wait, can I come along and talk with you?" Steve and Maria nodded. They spoke heatedly with the speaker about the demonstration and the ensuing riot. Steve and Maria expressed their concern that the young people only wanted an excuse to demonstrate and not to start a valid movement. They entered a coffee shop near their house, and the speaker followed them in. He wanted immediate change, he expressed aggressively. His own group wanted to locate people interested in this initiative to start an alliance for world change. He described how the speakers had been talking about social revolution rather than change from within. Contrary to Steve's and Maria's ideas, he insisted that violence helps a cause. He felt there was a big gulf between America and himself. He felt people could be shocked and traumatized into accepting and wanting a new order and a new future. Steve and Maria spoke of the I Ching, also known as the Book of Changes. They said that change must be guided, that knowing and planning what is right for the future are a key to avoiding violence. They attempted to dissuade the stranger from promoting violence. Steve admitted that when he suffered psychically before he was diagnosed, he was more influenced by true fortune-telling in this reactive sense of wanting to overthrow rather than to compromise. It was like an illogical, traumatic psychological upheaval bearing resemblance to its cousin, psychological upheaval. It was rather different from what he believed in now, which was tricking the mind into peaceful plan-making and practical hope in order to construct a new future catalytically using the I Ching, Book of Changes, as a creative and spiritual exercise. He reminded the other man that violent change could be forced on people as a whole, but it would unnecessarily hurt a large number of individuals. He hadn't given up the idea that he didn't know what was good for America, or for that matter, that someone can predict the future. But he thought it was bigoted to lay upon the world trauma, anarchy, and misfortune rather than good fortune. For that reason, he stayed away from letting such whims control his way of thinking. He based his predictions on a larger amount of practicality fortified with true belief and creativity. As for traumatizing people into believing in something that they find foreign or different, that is not the way of natural law. That in itself is the nature of inquisitiveness. He hinted that this was what the demonstrator wanted to boast about to his followers. He could shock them into accepting an unquestionably quick fix because their misfortune would make them see that there was only one way to address conflict. They attempted to encourage the speaker to contemplate the enigma of life by throwing the I Ching. He did and threw the hexagram called the abyss. The demonstrator became overexcited and defensive. He said that is exactly how he feels, like there is a big abyss between him and America, and it was created by the police beating him up just before he left with Steve and Maria. He thought it was a predilection that they were using the police's mores on him, which was synonymous with the concept of an abyss. Steve tried to calm him. He felt that some pain should be accepted rather than spoken against, and that nonviolent resistance, including a measure of self-inflicted pain, is necessary. He told the story of his hospital stay and the mismanagement of his medication. He revealed that he didn't hold grudges on all those people because he himself had sold small quantities of pot, which is a drug much like the psychiatric drugs. He never held himself responsible for what he had done, nor should he hold all the doctors and psych techs responsible for incorrect dosages and analytical errors. Their consciences should hold them responsible. Most of them probably thought they had been doing the best thing for him. Steve said it is human law that mankind can, with conscience, correct its own accident. Thusly, we all hold partial guilt of the accidents we create. In many cases, they never should have happened. He agreed with the protester that people have a certain right to be leery of others, but betrayal of foreign systems by shock-provoking techniques is not the way, he chided. He himself had eventually learned that logical persuasion and compromise are the only way. Baffled and bewildered, the demonstrator said he thought that stunning the ignorant person into an awakened state is the only way to wake up Americans. Maria countered, "Isn't it hypocrisy to stun a person into submissiveness? Isn't that the very thing you are fighting against, such as the use of the stun gun? Wasn't Jesus a substitute for the lambs of slaughter, and shouldn't we too try to be substitutes and gladly accept some pain? Isn't some struggle an honor to accept? That is how we shall bridge this abyss, not by force." "You people are very convincing," the speaker said, "but you can't deny that people are being sacrificed, much like Jesus was, with only a bloody cross for people to remember them by." "Like Kent State." "I was just thinking," Steve muttered. "You've heard the term blood for oil. If blood is capitalistically wasted, that's definitely wrong. The blood of the pacifist shouldn't bring more blood. It should bring more consciousness. That's why I'm partially afraid of the story of Jesus, because it doesn't inspire consciousness in all cases. It's too bloody. It's partly an emblem of the boaster, I think, not to put Jesus down. Throughout history, he was stigmatized by religious boasters who professed to believe in his blood." As they parted, the radical speaker said, "You two are real dragons of peace. I don't know whether you've changed me, but you have made me think." Later, Steve and Maria returned home, and Frank and Bev arrived with somebody they had contacted at the demonstration. They shared their disillusionment with demonstrations and the feeling of powerlessness over the conflicts that went down at the demonstration. Frank and Bev nodded in agreement. This was a realization that they had encountered themselves long ago. Frank and Bev thought the person they had brought along might be able to help Maria in relation to the mafia-like coup that had overthrown the government while she had lived in South America. Frank and Bev had talked with this person about Steve and Maria possibly having been kidnapped. He ran a human rights watch group in South America. He said he might be able to get information about how birth records were kept in South America. He also might be able to help with info about the parts that had been erased on her birth certificate. They discussed getting together an inspection of human and political rights overseers in Colombia with the man who ran the group that promoted human rights in South America. The person from the demonstration mentioned that he had heard that there were many children abandoned and some kidnapped when the mafia took over her country. From what he understood, there might be hidden records somewhere. He stated that if they needed help in taking this to Congress, his group could bring these violations before Congress to demand reparation. Maria said that she would remember them and try to involve the civil rights groups in anything important. She asked that he keep quiet and only speak openly about any of the proof they had discovered with their permission. These people, together with Maria, Steve, and their friends, decided they would put together a conscientious group to take into account the laws broken in Colombia and devise possible resolutions to the turmoil. The main thing they thought they could do was get Maria to go before Congress and explain what she had experienced. Even if she hadn't been kidnapped, she had been threatened. Maria decided, with their folk rock band being popular, their manure gas business underway, Maria's chain of bakeries working efficiently and profitably, they had enough money to start a charitable organization relating to political and human rights. They could promote it on their website along with their other activities. They would do this discreetly and not reveal any obvious info until they had absolute proof. Maybe I should contact a government official, too, who could research what was written on that birth certificate, Maria said. But then again, I don't think I should tell them about the identification directly at first, but just tell them that I had some possible evidence of something strange going on that could be an indication that my parents were other than who I supposed them to be. I could ask them if they have any connections with people in my country. I could ask them who I can trust to research some family trees in Colombia to see whether certain people might be my real parents without telling them about my birth certificate. Maybe it would be a good idea to see if there were children who might have been switched. It would have to be done quietly as to prevent the mafia-like government from burning the documents to destroy the evidence. The person from the demonstration said, "This seems like it could be something bigger than all of us put together. From now on, let's keep it a secret. Only tell those who we think should know." They all agreed and decided to keep in contact. The demonstrator said that Maria and Steve should mention to whomever they worked with on the project that he can get some covert information about them because he had connections in South America. Later that week, Maria, Steve, and the old couple went to an office that performed DNA testing. The doctor in charge got chummy with the group, recognizing Steve and Maria as the well-known folk rock group that they were. After giving them a confidentiality form to sign, the doctor said, "You know, you can't distinguish who to trust in the world today. They say we stand divided, but science and religion have to separate the exploiters of the weak in a unified effort. It's like faith holds people together when truth should take its place as much as possible." "It's funny," muttered Steve. "Both Maria and I have had irrefutable experiences of the Godhead, but it was based more upon faith rather than upon proof. There is a lack of solid proof of love and oneness. Sadly, we stand on ground that is really debatable in its integrity. Maybe this DNA test will be solid proof and will separate the exploiter from the feeling that the true soul has of direct connection with the spirit. It will prove that there really is a conflict with evil, and it will put truth on a more solid ground." "Wandering, searching, and seeking," the doctor said, "are what people do to discover truth. If we become a more enlightened society, we might alter that statement to mean that while you must wander to find truth, those conditions are separate from the truth, no matter how exciting they may seem. Searching should be simplified by science. We must become acquainted with the truth, both religiously and scientifically. We don't know yet how this test will come out, but hopefully you should have your results within a week." He looked at the group standing close together and smiled. "You people seem to get along well. You seem like family already." "We have become very close and plan to work together, whether we are family or not. We have a lot in common," said Maria. When the procedure was over, they said goodbye to the doctor and left. He seemed to know the truth in faith, and they agreed that he knew that truth surpasses understanding. A week later, Steve and Maria received a call from the doctor. "The results of your test indicate that there is a 99% probability that Frank and Bev are your parents. Congratulations!" Steve felt his spiritual load lighten considerably. "This is going to get rid of a lot of my insecurity," he said. "Uncertainty and insecurity go together. I, at least, have found someone, real parents I can trust. Eventually, we'll have to get the police on this. For now, we have to keep this secret and plan how we're going to handle it. I want to talk with a detective before the police burst in and list my parents under suspicion of kidnapping. I'm wondering if they are bad relatives who are part of our clan without being my real family. They could be as close as fifth or sixth cousins and still have very similar DNA," the doctor advised. "I think if you have time, you should go see somebody official right away." I want to talk to a lawyer or a detective first and collaborate with the police later, Steve declared.
This ends chapter 18 of my podcast novel. I hope you can come back again. Adios.